April 24th, 1984 at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. Our speaker today in chapel, Dr. Creighton Lacey, Professor of World Christianity at the Divinity School, Duke.
The late Dr. Kenneth Scott Laterette, Sterling Professor of Missions and Oriental History at Yale, who was a friend and confidant of our guest today, said of his monumental study of Christian missions, "My writing was an outgrowth of the global outreach of the Christian faith. The setting of my work is the entire range of mankind's record." The same profound commitment lies behind the remarkable professional achievements of our guest today. Some of those attainments are outlined for you in the order of worship. I have special reason today to welcome to our campus Dr. Creighton Lacey, Professor of World Christianity in the Divinity School of Duke University. He was my cherished friend and mentor in my days on that faculty, and he is well known to all of us here at Southeastern as a colleague in a neighboring institution. Not only do we welcome him, but we're also pleased that his wife, Fran, could accompany him, and we welcome her to this service also. Now, I have known Dr. Lacey for a long time as a man whose life is ordered by reason and grace, as a person of simplicity, humility, and openness, in whose life and writings we find the gospel made visible. We shall hear him gladly following the anthem by the choir.
is a great honor to be invited to participate in this series of Missionary Day addresses, and particularly to be introduced by my friend and former colleague, John Carlson. It is a great honor also to be invited a second time to this Missionary Day series, and that is a joy to bring me back to the Wake Forest campus of this distinguished seminary. We at Duke cherish our relations with particularly the faculty of Southeastern, which we renew each year in Thanksgiving week. But for me, this is a very real Thanksgiving occasion in the Easter season. At least in the 20th century, many missionaries at least have recognized the importance, nay, the necessity, of listening to Christians who have been raised in different cultures, in different experiences, with different perspectives. But we are increasingly wondering, as we hear so many conflicting voices around the world, which third world theology should we attend and listen to? Which third world, in the first place? The very name is attributed to Mao Zedong, whether rightly or wrongly, I do not know. But there are many different categories by which we label the third world. There are the economic measurements, the developed, the developing, the underdeveloped. Nobody likes to be undeveloped or still in the process of starting that process. There are the political categories. Most of the countries included in the so-called third world are ex-colonial nations, territories who are still suffering the economic and educational and social dependence of that period. There are the geographic distinctions by which we are divided not so much in East and West any longer as in North and South. 90% of the manufacturing industries of this globe are in the northern hemisphere, and yet in areas which are represented by all of the power of trade and commerce and banking and the international institutions of that kind. There are the cultural divisions, for when we talk about the third world, we sometimes use this in a pejorative, superior sense, in which the ancient, traditional, tightly knit societies are sometimes regarded as backward or primitive. Or there are the religious categories, for most of them come from non-Christian cultures and societies, although Christianity, of course, now permeates all of the third world in varying degrees. Where do we put, for example, Japan, which has a Western economy and a Northern geography, but an Asian culture and religious background? Where do we put the various parts of Africa with its highly developed southern cone of South Africa and with the great extent of newly independent and very race-conscious nations in the center? Where do we put, for example, Puerto Rico, part of our own United States territory, and yet one of the most economically destitute areas in the world? But more important than the question of which third world is the question, which theology? Are there really differences of theology, or is theology universal and eternal? Is there black theology and feminist theology and European theology and Protestant and Baptist and political theology? Or is the fact that we worship one Lord a requirement that we therefore have one theology? Much of the third world theology, as we shall be saying, is a reaction against and a correction of European theology. And I do not need to tell this audience any kind of a definition of European or American theology, although that may be very difficult for each one of us to define. But my questions and my categories and my criticisms will betray my particular prejudices and blind spots. And your reactions, your agreement or disagreement with some of the points I make, will betray your theology and your vested interests and perhaps ideologies. For convenience today, I am simply going to lump the generalized remarks that I make over three main areas, Latin America, Africa, and Asia, and let each one of you make his or her own applications and interpretations and assumptions. None of these areas is truly homogeneous. All depend on a great variety of characteristics, large areas of diverse cultural and historic backgrounds. But my basic thesis is simply that the third world theology is not uniform, not consistent, but depends rather on a host of historical and cultural situations. Russell Chandran of India, the principal of the United Theological Seminary in Bangalore, has said, "We do not regard everyone doing theology in a third world region as a third world theologian. We must have an orientation to do theological reflection on the gospel of Jesus Christ as it comes alive in the totality of the struggle of an oppressed people to be fully human." There is, as many of you know, an organization called by its acronym EATWAT for the Ecumenical Association of Third World Theologians, which began back in Dar es Salaam in 1976 and has had almost annual meetings in the period since then, drawing together a membership of over 50 theologians from 25 or more different countries, and including in most of their sessions representatives of United States minorities, both women and ethnic minority groups, and some observers. This is both Roman Catholic and Protestant. And their reports and personal interviews with many of their spokespersons in various parts of the third world have constituted the bulk of what I want to say today. First of all, there are significant area differences in the third world. As one of the EATWAT reports puts it, "In no way can it be claimed that third world theology is identical with the theology of liberation of Latin America, as has been claimed in many circles. There is a wider theological gap between the Latin American and Central African Catholics than there is between Latin American Catholics and Protestants." What are some of these differences of perspective? In Latin America, of course, though the countries had a relatively early political liberation from their colonialism, they have continued to be culturally and economically dependent. The Roman Catholic Church has been allied with European powers, and the church has encouraged the development of an internal or national elite that carries on many of the same perspectives, same vested interests, same powers that the former colonial authorities did. The Protestants, because they have been for many decades a persecuted minority, have tended to be pietistic, biblical, and to resist any challenge either to the Roman Catholic Church or to the political authorities. In this century, of course, Western urban society has sharpened the class conflicts of Latin America, very often along Marxist lines. Or for another dimension, only Guatemala, Brazil, Peru, Ecuador, and Bolivia have any significant Indian minorities left in their population. And therefore, their encounter with other religions has been absolutely negligible, and they have made no effort at dialogue in the sense in which it is so important, as we shall see, in the countries of Asia. Africa was more thoroughly divided up, as you all know, among the colonial powers, with probably less participation by the national residents of the continent in the government and economy of the continent. Therefore, there has been a sharper contrast between European Christianity and the so-called heathen, idolatrous, traditional superstitions of Africa. More of the economic profits were sent back to Europe. Less were reinvested for the use of the African people themselves. Europeans earlier denied that any of the ancient cultures of Africa could really have arisen from such assumed backward people. In fact, they often attribute the phenomenal construction of the Zimbabwe ruins to Phoenicians rather than Africans, saying that it was passed above the capacities of early African inhabitants. And in the post-war period, of course, in the struggle for independence, there has been a large, inescapable racial component which continues in the tragedy of apartheid South Africa. Asia, on the other hand, has a rich heritage of art and culture, of inventions and literature and religions. The total diversity as to the ethnic groups, the languages, the social development, and so on of Asia make it almost impossible to generalize about that continent. Development in the economic and social and political sense has perhaps made greater strides there, where people are recognizing, acknowledging, and welcoming a shift in living standards. The open door policy of this country and of European powers kept China and to some extent Japan autonomous, and many of the powers of Asia which have received their independence from colonialism have had in the past a more enlightened policy of government and of education. Christianity for Asia has been an intellectual encounter rather than a political adjunct as in Latin America or a civilizing component as in Africa. But what does bind third world theology together? One factor, of course, has been the common concern for the poor and oppressed. Eatwat started by third world theologians who say that they considered the division between rich and poor as the major phenomenon of contemporary history. And therefore, from that very starting point, we feel, or actually we are, threatened here because we are the rich. We are the affluent. We are, in a sense, the opposition. The concern for the poor is an old idea, and I need not spell out to this audience all of the biblical references, beginning not only with the Exodus, the political exodus from Egypt, but also the passages in Deuteronomy, "You shall open your hand to your brother, to the needy and the poor," from Micah, and from the other prophets, "They covet fields and seize them and homes and take them away. Is it not for you to know justice, you who hate the good and love the evil, who tear the skin up from off my people and their flesh from off their bones?" In the New Testament, we need go no further than the Magnificat, or than Jesus' first sermon in Nazareth in Luke 4, or his passages about how he was in prison and hungry and naked, and we visited or did not visit our Lord, or the way in which the early church had all things in common and shared with the poor, with, it might be pointed out, an evangelistic consequence of great numbers being added to their communal ranks. No one doubts the concern of God and of Jesus during his earthly life with the poor. The Catholics call it an option for the poor, though for myself it seems to me more nearly a mandate, an obligation. And yet this point precisely is the point of misunderstanding and resentment from those of us who are affluent. Does this preference for the poor mean that God condemns, withholds salvation, does not love those who are rich? Some third world theologians answer with a resounding yes. Raymond Fung of Hong Kong says, the world is divided into two categories, the sinners and the sinned against. Does this imply that the rich are greater sinners in all areas of life? Does it imply that they or we are sinners because we are rich? Does this imply that the poor are less guilty of sin? Leonardo Boff, one of the outstanding Roman Catholic theologians of Brazil, says, the poor are not blessed because they are good, better than others, but because they are poor and oppressed, unquote. But this does not take into account the definitions of the poor or the degree of blessing. There are qualifications, modifications, even from Latin America. Jorge Pantelis, a refugee first from Bolivia and then from Brazil, now living in Uruguay, has written that that Latin American theologians stress that the poor are blessed because they are victims. But he goes on to say they also need the good news preached. They also are sinners. And it is not possible, he adds, for liberation theology to accept this concept of equal poverty in the sight of God. Asian qualifications have been more interesting and more diverse. The New Delhi Statement of 1981 says there was general agreement that the basis of third world theologies is the struggle of the poor and oppressed against all forms of injustice and domination. Yet one must immediately follow with a caveat that in Delhi, neither poverty nor oppression constituted a univocal term. Asia has had a variety of attitudes toward the poverty that is so central in Latin American theology. Asian attitude in the traditional religions has been either that poverty and suffering are part of one's karma, one's destiny, one's religious inheritance, and therefore to be accepted with resignation, with acquiescence. Or Asians have tended to stress the harmony of human beings with nature and the cyclical nature of history rather than the demand for progress and for material goals. And an African reservation is perhaps about this poverty issue is perhaps of interest also. For poverty in Africa has been defined as more often a matter of culture and human nature, of identity and pride and essence, rather than in economic terms. One African nun in Tanzania wrote not long ago in the Marinol publication, in Africa, we don't view poverty as a lack of food or money. We judge poverty not as lack of things, but as lack of family, a widow who is childless, or an old man living alone. Another common characteristic, perhaps, of third world theology is the protest, the counter arguments to traditional European theology as being too abstract, too conceptual, too philosophical. The Dar es Salaam Statement of 1976 said, the theologies from Europe and West and North America are dominant today in our churches and represent a form of cultural domination. They are related to conditions in those countries and therefore not to be adopted uncritically without raising questions of relevance in the third world. And it went on to say, we reject as irrelevant an academic type of theology that is divorced from action. Mortimer Arias, another Latin American refugee now in California from his homeland of Bolivia, says, the theology of liberation was not the product of seminary professors working at their desks, but the reflection of Christians engaged in human struggles. There is a delightful Asian twist also in the response of Kosuke Koyama, now professor of ecumenics at Union Theological Seminary in New York, who said in an interview that I had with him a couple of years ago, the poverty of theological education is that it is so theological. What he meant, of course, was that it is so doctrinal, that it is so preoccupied with debates about the nature of God or the person of Christ or the Trinity or eschatology and so on, rather than, to use Koyama's own vivid Asian metaphors, with water buffaloes and with monsoons and with apartheid. Theology, he reminds us, gives us no handle on the cross. But even in the definition of theology, our third world theologians begin to diverge. In the New Delhi Statement of 1981, they said, it was in formulating our understanding of theology that the sharpest differences appeared in the discussion of our Asian report group. We recognized that our different contexts, values, and experiences had led us to different theological perspectives and priorities. If it was true among four nations of Asia, how much more true is it of four different continents? And yet note that the conclusion was that these differences are in perspective and priorities, not in fundamental truth. Latin America comes through loud and clear in some of its liberation theologians. Gustavo Gutierrez of Chile, of Peru, who many people regard as the father of liberation theology, has said that theology is, quote, critical reflection on historical praxis. A second step of critical reflection which follows after the praxis of faith. Magaiz Bonino, who was with us last semester and who spoke at one time at least on this campus, said, truth is at the level of history, not in the realm of ideas. Rather, action is itself the truth. And Gutierrez, in another of his writings, has claimed that questions of wealth and class and economic status and so on are rooted in liberation practice, and they are the starting point and the ultimate criterion for liberation theology. But even in Latin America, there are more cautious, more moderate voices. One of these is Juan Luis Segundo in Uruguay, who wrote in his Liberation of Theology, theology is not an interpretation of mankind and society, not in the first place at least. Theology does implicitly or explicitly assert its independence from the sciences that deal with the present. Theology, he goes on, is based on a book, on a record, on history, on the word. And in a personal conversation in which I asked him point blank, how do you define theology? Segundo replied, it is to understand our faith, to understand it in an intellectual sense in order to cope with problems in a more complete, more human way. Asia has a somewhat different perspective on even the definition of theology. One theologian in the Philippines wrote, we shall define theology very simply as an understanding of our belief in God and its bearing on our contemporary life experience. Notice belief in God, not the economic, socio-political situation. Peter Lee of Hong Kong, speaking about Latin American liberation theology, says, "While I do not doubt that it is particularly pertinent in that part of the world, in view of the oppressive structures there, I don't think that we need to import the whole motif without qualification. There are oppressive elements in Asia, yes, but they are not as entrenched as in South America. What the nations in our part of the world need is not more revolution, but building up of people." And he adds, "There is little chance for the inroad of a faddish North American theology," he might also have said Latin American theology, "that sheds the transcendent God." What are some of the characteristics, and how do they transmit themselves into the theology of these various areas? You yourself can answer these questions as well as I. Let me just make a few suggestions. In Africa, the traditional religions center around the rich culture of tribal and family relationships. The ancestors are a part of what they call the living dead, a real and vital part of the community, along with the spirits of nature. The supreme being, Mwari, Nkosi, whatever he may be called, is a powerful but remote creator. And there is a strong emphasis on origins, on creation, on the primeval age, on the cosmos. Very little awareness or concern for the future. There is a strong consciousness of symbolism and myth, on the sacralization of life at a very time when we in the West are tending to desacralize most of our aspects of everyday living. In the contemporary scene, with the struggle for political independence, still leaning toward a large reliance on European colonialism, there is a pride in the new freedom movement and solidarity with the still unliberated blacks of South Africa. But there is also an awareness that much of their cultural and social and economic heritage still comes from the internal elite of their own countries and ultimately from the external elite of Europe. There is a basic tension in Africa, in the African theology, between the need for indigenization, which is a cultural aspect, and the need for liberation, which is a political and economic concept. Some Christian theologians in Africa see indigenization, the rediscovery of the rich heritage of African music and dance and tribal customs and so on, as being backward and primitive. They are eager to renounce the magic, the witchcraft, the superstition of the past, along with the poverty and disease of the past. And therefore, they want to define even contextualism, even indigenization, in terms of adaptation to a modern urban industrial context. But despite the diversity of the continent in climate, in language, in resources, in tribes, there is a growing consciousness of African solidarity. Charles Nyamiti of Tanzania says, "One should beware of reducing black theology to the theme of liberation from white segregation." Alan Bosack, who visited us a couple of years ago at Duke and who many of you perhaps have heard, now the president of the World Alliance of Reformed Churches and a prominent colored theologian in South Africa, has said, "Black theology is a theology of liberation. It seeks a God of the Bible who is totally and completely different from the God of the Bible the whites have so long been preaching to us. God is a God of liberation, not oppression, justice, not injustice, freedom rather than subservience, love, righteousness, and community rather than hatred, self-interest, and exploitation. But, interestingly enough, Bosak goes on to reject the extreme statements of some of our own black theologians, such as James Cone. Bosak, quote, "Cone claims God solely for the black experience. I submit that to make black as such the symbol for oppression in the world is to absolutize one's own situation, to make liberation the ultimate criterion for all theology." Cone's contention, and I'm still quoting Bosak, Cone's contention is that to love is to make a decision against white people, that racism is the only demon, is to pervert true liberation as well as the gospel of Jesus Christ. I had the rich privilege a few years ago of a private interview with President Kenneth Kaunda of Zambia, one of the Christian statesmen of Africa, along with Julius Nyerere in Tanzania and Kanan Banana in Zimbabwe and others who might be mentioned. And because Kenneth Kaunda had built his newly independent nation on the basis of what was called Zambian humanism, I asked him point blank, just what do you mean? We in the West tend to think of humanism as a rejection of God, a reliance on finite, scientific, materialistic powers. But before I could even finish my question, he put up his hand and he says, no, that is not at all. We take our stand very clearly that all human life flows from God, that in all our activities we are dealing with God's men and women. And therefore, there is no question of leaving God out. It is precisely because man is God's most important creation that there is any reason for building schools and hospitals, expanding agricultural production, struggling for justice and freedom. But it is God's man. That is how we see it. This is the African perspective of concern for people. One other major point, and then I must omit many of the issues which some of you might like to follow up. But there is a significant difference, as I have already suggested, between the main areas of third world theology in attitudes toward world religions. Latin America, there has been some evidence of spiritism coming in from the Caribbean and from Africa and its own tribes. Catholicism absorbed many of these most primitive forms, but liberation theology has tended to ignore the indigenous people and cultures. Africa has a spreading Islam from North Africa down through the Sahara to the central part of the continent, and a substantial influence of Hinduism and Islam along the East African coast from India and Pakistan. Both missionaries and African church leaders have given and are giving more attention to understanding and accepting or rejecting the traditional African religions, with its problems of polygamy and divination and ancestral cults and prophet movement and so on. But the most exciting and in some ways the most vital religious movements in the African continent today are those of the so-called independent or Zionist or separatist or spiritist churches. Some of them under Christian, some of them under predominantly Old Testament influences. But Asia, of course, has had thousands of years of dialogue and coexistence and mutual influence with ancient religions of the past. With Hinduism, metaphysical, speculative, contemplative, with Buddhism, individualistic, humanistic, moving toward salvation, recognizing social change, but not ever advocating violence. Confucianism, seeking to achieve social harmony in this life before speculating about the world beyond. Father Panacker of India, who is a fascinating blend in his own personal tradition of Buddhism, of Hinduism and Roman Catholic, Catholicism, says that these various religions meet in God, not in their conception of God, but in God the ultimate. And Christians, as well as non-Christians, are coming to assume that there is some truth, some revelation in other faiths. Otherwise, we and they will seem to be imperialistic, dogmatic, exclusive, insensitive not only to other cultures, but to the way in which God works for salvation among other cultures and other peoples. As Koyama says, pluralism is part of the very air we Asians breathe. And yet it is not easy for Christians in either the West or the East to construct a satisfactory relationship between the various faiths. Are we the Panikkar's theme of the unknown Christ in Hinduism claims that Christ is behind any form of worship in so much as it is an adoration of the transcendent. But are we willing to talk of an unknown Buddha in Christianity, or say that there is no God but Allah, or that we are saved by Krishna, only we simply don't know it? Today, most Protestant and Catholic theologians agree that there is divine revelation in the non-Christian religions, but there is less agreement on the issue of salvation. And yet this agreement, uncertainty, confusion, is part of the fundamental struggle and focus of theology, Christian theology, in Asia. There are many other areas that it would be fascinating to explore: the varying Christologies of Asia, Africa, and Latin America, the status of women, the concept of history between the cyclical view that Koyama defines so graphically in Water Buffalo Theology or in No Handle on the Cross versus the linear progress that the Latin Americans, along with us Westerners, tend to make. But I must conclude and add that because I have expressed a negative viewpoint about certain third world positions, probably with my own Asian bias, some listeners may assume that I am critical of or opposed to third world theology. Quite the contrary, I have written and spoken for many decades about the need for the church in the West, for comfortable, complacent, affluent Christians to heed the voices of other cultures, other churches, other followers of Christ. We do not have a monopoly on the truth or an interpretation of God's will and purposes and activities in the world. Rather, I've attempted to say that as the third world theologians themselves are beginning to discover, the variations of culture and history and psychology and social heritage are part of the third world that produce different responses to the same universal Christ, the same universal good news. The conviction that they need to listen to one another, to recognize that poverty and exploitation create some common elements, but not a monolithic uniform theology, should not blind us to our own even greater need to listen to people whose cultures are actually closer to that of Jesus and the people of the Bible, and whose experience of suffering, injustice, and deprivation do seem to fit them to receive the promises of God incarnated in Jesus Christ more keenly, perhaps, than we. I was going to close with a lengthy quotation from Dr. K.H. Ding of China, because it illustrates dramatically the variations, but I do not want to infringe on your time any further, except to say that what Dr. Ding concludes out of the struggle and pain and isolation of the Christian church in China during these last 30 years is that while many of the concerns of poverty, of exploitation, of injustice, and so on are shared throughout the third world, for the Chinese church, the ultimate message of the gospel is one of reconciliation and one of love and forgiveness, rather than one of what he calls glorifying the poor or absolutizing the revolution. It is in that spirit and in that rediscovery that Christ transforms even cultures, to use Richard Niebuhr's dramatic Christ in culture analogy, that Christ transforms even cultures. Christ transforms the lives that have given their allegiance to him. But above all, he brings us together in a unity of understanding, of sharing, and of fellowship. May we be more aware than we have ever been before of the indebtedness to Christians of other cultures, to what God has done and said to each of these continents and peoples, but in seeking above all to find our unity in Jesus Christ. Let us pray. May God, who has called his children out of many cultures and many lands and many races, bind us together in a common search for the means of loyalty and discipleship to his Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord. And may he send us forth into a world of need, of hope, and of promise. In the name of Jesus Christ, now and forevermore. Amen.